Do you remember the John Cleese movie, A Fish Called Wanda? John wrote about a character called Jamie, played by Jamie Lee Curtis, who became multi-orgasmic every time she heard the French language. It's relevant because I'm about to introduce you, in fact reintroduce you, to Mary Norris, who confesses that when she hears Greek, she has an erotic thrill. Mary has gone by many names in the course of her career: language whisperer, grammar geek, nitpicker, and of course, comma queen. A dangerous profession at a magazine which was once described as having commas with which fall with the precision of knives in a circus act outlining the victim. Mary joined me in the studio back in December 2015 to talk about her first book, Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. The book became an instant bestseller, and Mary is now an internet sensation, attracting legions of fans with her blogs and online tutorials about grammar conundrums. It's great to have her back on The Blower from New York to talk about her newie, Greek to Me. Welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
Tell me, confess all, why do you find Greek erotic?
Well, it always takes me by surprise, but I found it erotic in the beginning. You know how when you study a language, you have to make an association with words from that language to your own language. And Greek seemed to me to be heightened somehow from with its because of its associations with English. For instance, the Greek word for the sun, Ilios, in English, what would I associate that with, of course, is Helios, which is the sun god. So, you know, it's not just the sun in Greek. It still is kind of a god, but it's the word is tossed around just the way we talk about the sun here without being actual sun worshipers. So there's that daily response, you know, there's that response to the words on that are everyday words. And there's just something about the language that when I hear it, when I'm in a classroom or when I'm in Greece, that wakens something up in me that English.
Well, I want to go back to the time, in fact, almost to the moment when you were first aroused. You saw Time Bandits, the Terry Gilliam movie about a band of time traveling dwarves plundering treasure from the past. And one scene, set in ancient Greece, had Sean Connery in a cameo as Agamemnon, battling the Minotaur.
Right. It was that movie and that scene in that movie in the background. Well, of course, there was Sean Connery, but the background was very austere, you know, no vegetation, just a sort of sandy-looking rocky land and very blue sky. Much later, I found out it was shot in Morocco, but I thought, naturally, it was Greece because it was ancient Greece that the scene was set in, and I wanted to go there right away.
Didn't you make a sales pitch to New Yorker to facilitate that?
I did. It's a little... The New Yorker would pay for its employees to take courses in anything that had a bearing on your job. So I wanted to go to Greece. I studied modern Greek, and the magazine covered my tuition. But when I was in Greece, I decided I wanted to study ancient Greek. And when I came back and started studying ancient Greek and handed over the bill to the New Yorker, they declined.
But you were able, of course, to keep a dossier of sorts in which you listed words from the Greek that cropped up in the New Yorker, everything from pie to ophthalmologist.
Yes, I was determined to prove to them that ancient Greek was indeed relevant to English and to my job on the copy desk. So there were a lot of words. There was autochthonous and anything that came up like ophthalmologist, I could make a case for that, for the spelling of that, for the etymology of that, for knowing that to be useful to my job. And maybe someone else would have caught the mistake who didn't know Greek, but it was very apparent to somebody who had even a little bit of Greek.
Talking to Mary Norris, and I'll hold her book up to the microphone so you can all see it, Greek, Greek to Me, and it's terrific. Where does the title come from? I know the answer to that, but I want you to tell me.
It's Julius Caesar. It's Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Casca says to somebody else in the play, I don't have the script in front of
Cassius,
me.
Cassius, as I recall.
I think it's Casca.
Okay.
He's speaking to Cassius, you say. Okay. He is asked, well, what did so-and-so say? And he says, it was Greek to me, meaning I don't have any idea.
You say that the alphabet is the greatest invention of humankind, and I learn from you that we have to thank the ancient Greeks for giving us ours. I didn't realize that the Greeks adapted the Phoenician alphabet, which was utterly lacking in vowels.
Yes, they say that the mythology, the myth is that Cadmus, who was a prince of Phoenicia and the founder of Thebes, when he came to Thebes, he adapted the Phoenician alphabet to suit the Greek language, and he added vowels to it, or he recasts, he used some of those letters or the names of the letters or shapes as vowels, which gave the Greek alphabet breath. It gave it spirit.
It gave it a vowel motion.
I would say vowel movement.
Well, okay. I had no idea that the Phoenicians only had 22 consonants.
Yes, that was it. They didn't have a lot of Scrabble players, I guess, in ancient Phoenicia. So the Greeks added a few. They added consonants. They made some of the sounds of the Phoenician alphabet, they repurposed them to make vowels out of them.
There's a controversial suggestion that the alphabet may have been invented, this alphabet, to set down Homer.
Yes. Well, the earliest evidence they have of alphabetic writing in Greek dates to about the same time that Homer was first written down, that the Iliad and the Odyssey were first written down. And, you know, it's only circumstantial evidence, of course, so it is very controversial. And who can know, right? But there is a theory that the alphabet was developed deliberately with the idea of setting down Homer so that the poems could travel farther, you know, so that you didn't have to have a bard singing it, and so that they would be remembered instead of having to keep them in your head or pass them down to your children and have your children pass them down to their children. You could have them on a papyrus or whatever they used.
We don't have a lot of royalty on our program, and we do have a queen on this occasion, Mary Norris, the comma queen. And you point out that we already know more Greek than we think we do. I know, of course, Eureka, that's a word which resonates in Australian history, but that's about it. Fill me in.
So many, many, many words come to us directly from Greek, and others have been invented, made out of parts of Greek. But the word Bible comes directly from the Greek biblios. The word cycle, as in bicycle, comes from Greek. I think bi is actually Latin, so that would be a hybrid. The word economy is directly from the Greek. Geometry. Horizon.
I'm just riffling through your pages, and I see that, for example, psychology, psychosomatic, psychiatrist, psychopath, all derived from Psyche.
Right, who was the bride of Eros, who was the son of Aphrodite. I love those words that begin with psi. Looks like a pitchfork in Greek.
I also learn with considerable delight that the Greek for newspapers is related to the English ephemera, things that last a day.
Yes, the Greek is ephemerida. You see it outside of newsstands and on the kiosks in the street. And it just means, you know, this is only going to be interesting for a single day, ephemera.
I find the book delightful, but I've always had a problem with Greek mythology. I always found it, well, inexplicable, and I couldn't decode it. You delight in it.
Oh, yes, I love it. It may have something to do with my having lost my faith in my childhood religion, and you need something. And the Greek gods, I took a course in mythology when I was in college, and something about those Greek gods just resonated with me. You know, they gave you more models for women than the Catholic Church does. There's Athena, who has great wisdom, Artemis, who is a huntress, kind of a tomboy, you might say, Aphrodite, the great beauty, who's always getting into trouble, and that's a consolation to those of us who are not great beauties. We don't get into quite so much trouble, necessarily. And then there are, of course, aspects of all the male gods, Zeus being such a philanderer and so powerful and frightening to the other gods, and Apollo being very disciplined, and Dionysus, of course, having a drop of wine now and then. One of the things I think is so interesting is that Hephaestus, who is the blacksmith god who makes jewelry, is lame. Now, wouldn't you think a god would have no physical problems? So I think Hephaestus is an example of someone who, despite physical handicaps, can make great use of the rest of his body, you know, he can make beautiful things.
Mary, you make the point that Athena turned out to be a particularly good model for a copy editor, because she wouldn't worry about offending a writer or whether a writer liked her or not. She wouldn't let anyone get away with anything.
That's true. There's a kind of sometimes a problem if a copy editor has a crush on a writer and doesn't want to rub that writer the wrong way, you know, you might go easy on the grammar, and that would be wrong. That would just be wrong. The writer deserves to be treated with, to have a thorough proofreading and to get the, you know, to get cleaned up, to have that prose cleaned up and to have the prose the best that writer can produce.
You insist the Greek classics reach across the ages and touch modern lives. Tell me about Antigone. That's written, what, over 2,000 years ago? Is that a case in point?
Yes. So many kind of martyrs really fall afoul of the law because what they're doing is they're obeying their inner sense of justice. Now, I'm not, you know, of course, I'm not going to be able to think of one now, but yes, there was the Christine Blasey Ford, that investigation into Kavanaugh for a Supreme Justice in the United States. That was a woman who just told her truth and was reviled for it and ignored. And yet, that is a kind of an Antigone story right there. Antigone.
We watch American politics with fascinated horror, and I think it's a very appropriate reference.
Well, the point is simply about Antigone, that she followed her own conscience. She did what she felt needed to be done. And what was done to her, that she was basically immured. She was condemned to death by her uncle, who was king. She was blameless. Sometimes when I make a mistake, even in copy editing, an ignorant mistake, I would invoke Antigone because I did something in good faith that turned out to bother someone and be wrong to someone, and there was nothing I could have done differently. So, you know, I'm not setting myself up as an Antigone, but, you know, Antigone's only sin was that she loved her brother.
Well, did try to set yourself up as Hecuba, and this is a terrific anecdote. It's one of my favorite moments in the book. You're playing Hecuba in an amateur production of The Trojan Women, and you have the cheek, the audacity, to write to a Hollywood movie star asking for tips on how to play the character.
Was that so audacious? It seemed like the natural thing to do. I had to play Hecuba in ancient Greek, and I had learned that Katharine Hepburn played Hecuba in a movie of The Trojan Women. I had missed the movie, and I didn't dare go and watch it just before having to play the part myself. You know, I don't sound or look anything like Katharine Hepburn, and that would be a disaster. But I did write to her. I had an address for her through her publisher. I didn't want to scare her or make her think I was a stalker. And she very kindly wrote back. I believe Katharine Hepburn might have had a reputation for being a good correspondent and getting back to people. Anyway, I had asked her to help me with the pacing of it. How can something that starts out so sad go anywhere? And I asked, do I dare play it for laughs? And that's what she answered. She said, by all means, play it for laughs. You have to, especially Hecuba.
So the ancient Greeks had a sense of humor. I must say, people would feel that it was all incredibly solemn.
Oh, no. All the tragedies even have funny moments in them. You know, a messenger will enter panting and say, look, that, you know, that's the original, don't kill the messenger, I believe is from Oedipus, when the messenger comes and he has to tell him, well, it was you, king. Or, you know, somebody died, and the messenger will go round and round and round begging for mercy before he'll say what he has to say. And then if he's lucky, he will be spared. His life will be spared. So they all have moments in them of humor. The original impulse to laugh, unfortunately, in Greek, was always at someone else's expense. Was to ridicule.
Well, that's not uncommon in modern humor, of course. I should point out to the listener that the book's paper cover is in sort of faux mosaic, and that reminds me that you have a particularly favorite place in Greece, which is famous for its mosaics.
Yes, Daphne. A cathedral, it was a monastery, not a cathedral, a monastery outside Athens, about 14 miles to the west. Only about 6 miles. I'm mixing it up with a different place. So it's now a national park, but it used to be a monastery, and the mosaics inside it are famous. I tried to get to see them twice, both times the church was closed because there had been a recent earthquake, and it was not a high priority in Greece to put mosaics back together again. Finally, I got into this chapel at the Monastery of Daphne. I have a wonderful friend who knew the archaeologists who were working on restoring the mosaics. So I got to see these beautiful things, the Christ Pantocrator, the Christ Almighty in the dome, the baptism of Christ, a nativity scene, and the mosaics are the most exquisite work of the Byzantine craftsmen who did that. Oh, they're so gorgeous.
I should tell you, dear listener, that Mary has made several pilgrimages to the Acropolis in Athens over the years, and it was all a waste of effort because she more recently discovered that there was a full-scale replica of the Parthenon in Nashville, Tennessee, of all places.
Yes, Nashville is famous for being a site of education. They called themselves in Nashville the Athens of the South. And as if to make that point, they built around in the early century to celebrate the centenary of the state, that is when the state entered the Union, they built a replica of the Parthenon, of the temple. The one funny thing about it, well, there are a couple funny things about it, I guess I have to admit, but you know, the one of the great things about the Parthenon in Athens is that it's up on the Acropolis, and you.
Yes, it's well sited. Mary, I'm sorry, I've got to wind us up. Although okay. I could keep going for hours, it's been a delight. Mary Norris, the Comma Queen from The New Yorker, her new book, and I'll hold it up again, Greek to Me, is out this week from our friends at Text Publishing. Thanks, Mary.